Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 21st, 2009, summer solstice. And today we have for you a show that I think you're really going to enjoy. Our guest, someone who's been on the program a few times before, and we're delighted to have her joining us again live from Canada. Naomi Klein will be our guest, talking about the state of the world today, the state of the world economy and politics, as always. Should be a wonderful hour. I hope you're going to enjoy it. Sit back, relax, and tune in. But before we go to Naomi Klein, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
87% of households now have cell phones, yet wireless policies have not changed since the days when cell phones were a luxury. Customers are still locked into contracts that constrain their choices of carriers, phones, and applications. Congress is looking into whether consumers are getting a fair deal. On June 16th, four senators sent a letter to the FCC asking for a review of exclusive arrangements between wireless carriers and cell phone manufacturers. On June 17th, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing on the issue. Paul Roth of AT&T told the committee that competition was thriving and that exclusive agreements were good for consumers. But John Rooney, president of mid-size wireless carrier U.S. Cellular, testified that four companies have hijacked consumer access to handset technology and squeezed the smaller companies out. 9 out of 10 of the top handsets, like the iPhone and the BlackBerry Storm, are under exclusive contracts to AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, or T-Mobile.
It's the customer that suffers, not my company. We serve many areas where we're the only carrier to build cell sites in the area, and those customers cannot get any of those phones. As our nation commits itself to an aggressive deployment of broadband to serve all Americans, it is vitally important that we get the issue of access to mobile wireless handsets right.
On the same day as the hearing, Free Press launched the Free My Phone campaign, calling on leaders in Washington to open up wireless networks and promote consumer choice. Campaign director Tim Carr says that, in addition to blocking access to certain phones, the Big Four block access to certain applications that compete with their own services. Carr says that carriers' promises of having the internet in your pocket aren't even close to being true.
A lot of people are considerably angry that AT&T has disabled certain features like multimedia text messaging and tethering, and they've disabled the Skype application that 2 million people have already downloaded onto their iPhones. And so that's where there's a lot of consumer anger that's bubbling up amongst this very large community of users. There are more than 5 million iPhones in service in the United States. And we are hoping through Free My Phone to just give some shape to that consumer revolt and hopefully move it eventually towards some policy solutions that would open up these networks.
For more information about changing cell phone policies, go to freepress.net/freemyphone.
There are 1.4 million people living in the New York City borough of the Bronx, but residents there have had little access to local news until now. The Bronx News Network is bringing local news to underserved neighborhoods in the Northwest Bronx and providing a way for residents to communicate with one another. Jordan Moss is the editor-in-chief of the Norwood News, which has been published biweekly since 1988 and serves as the flagship newspaper for the network. He says there has been no real local newspaper in the borough for decades. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation bought the only chain of Bronx weeklies a couple of years ago.
They bought up a whole chain of weeklies in Queens and Brooklyn as well. So the kind of independently run community newspaper is falling by the wayside.
Founded by the Norwood News and the nonprofit Moshaloo Preservation Corporation, a community development group, the Bronx News Network is comprised of six small local papers and serves as a web portal, a back-end support system, and advertising hub. Readers can learn about basic neighborhood happenings like PTA meetings and ESL classes, or share helpful information on issues like tenants' rights. The Bronx News Network sponsors a journalism program for high school students and trains citizen journalists. The network will also be working on investigative journalism.
We thought if we could have several community papers that we could work with, then we could kind of do the kind of in-depth things that as individuals, papers, we don't have time for.
The network's new website is aggregating the news from all six newspapers. The main blog includes daily news roundups, events, and slideshows. A growing diverse group of bloggers share their expertise and opinions on a variety of subjects. Moss says he hopes the network will be a megaphone for the Bronx.
I always say that neighborhoods that can't afford a vehicle like a local newspaper to hold the government accountable, those neighborhoods are the ones that need it the most. And so that's the gap that we fill.
For more information about the Bronx News Network, go to bronxnewsnetwork.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, June 21st, 2009, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, it's a great privilege to welcome as our guest, the award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author, Naomi Klein, probably best known for her books, The Shock Doctrine and also No Logo, writes for The Nation and The Guardian, and has become really one of the outstanding journalists and social commentators of our times. Naomi, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for that introduction.
Sure. And you're in Toronto, I assume, today?
I am, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, there's so much I want to talk about today with you, and I suspect our callers will have some issues they'd like to raise as well. But let's just talk about The Shock Doctrine, your most recent book. We had you on the program to talk about it when it first came out. For listeners who have not read the book or not familiar with it, could you just give a brief argument or summary of the thesis, then talk about what's going on in the world economy today and how it applies?
Mm-hmm. Well, The Shock Doctrine is an alternative history of how we ended up with this kind of market fundamentalism strain of capitalism that we have and that successfully imploded the global economy a few months back because of deregulation and rampant privatization and the corruption that goes along with it. So what I do in the book is make an argument about how we ended up with these policies that is different than the fairy tale version of history that we've been living with for a long time, which holds that, you know, we got this radical strain of capitalism because we wanted it, and you know, the Berlin Wall fell and the people of the world all wanted their Reaganomics. And instead what I'm arguing is that if we look at what I call the Big Bang moments, and I'm really looking at this globally, I'm not just looking at the United States, I'm looking at the Big Bang moments when this ideology has leapt forward, whether in the former Soviet Union in the mid-90s or Chile in the 70s, in Poland in 1989, in South Africa in the mid-90s. What you see is that before what economists call economic shock therapy, which is the rapid-fire restructuring of economies, takes place, there's always some other kind of shock, something that really it pushes a society off its moorings, and that could be an economic crisis, it could be a war, it could be a coup d'etat, it could be an incredibly shocking event like the Tiananmen Square massacre. So I'm looking at the interrelationship between crisis and the imposition of this right-wing ideology. And you know, this came out of research I had done you know, in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and that's when I started using the phrase disaster capitalism to describe this, because you had a natural disaster that was immediately seized by the right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, and you know, there was pretty much no difference between them and the Bush administration, going in and saying, okay, well, this is a crisis, but it's also an opportunity. Let's restructure the school system. Let's close the housing projects. Let's just ram through our wish list. And I had seen something very similar happen in Iraq after the bombing, where you had Paul Bremer and the neocons basically treating that country as their little petri dish. So that's what the Shock Doctrine's about. And you know, I do believe that I think we've become a lot more savvy about these tactics, basically because we've been living them for so long. And I think because the Bush administration was so explicit and so opportunistic, particularly in the way they used the 9/11 attacks and the fear and the regression that accompanied those attacks to push through their wish list domestically, you know, whether it was the Patriot Act or selling an illegal war, but also privatizing huge parts of the U.S. military. I think people had become really quite angry at having their traumas exploited in this way, so that when the economic crisis hit in September of last year, and you had Bush and Paulson saying, you know, if you don't give us $1 trillion, you know, we're all going to die. People were like, wait a minute, haven't we seen this tactic before? And, you know, I always remember there was a great skit on The Daily Show where it wasn't really a skit, but a segment on The Daily Show where they cut together Bush's speech where he sold the Iraq war, and talked about the imminent threat posed by Saddam Hussein, and intercut it with the speech that Bush was giving to rationalize the bailout. And he sort of had the same look in his eye, was using many similar language. And so I think we've definitely seen similar attempts to exploit the economic crisis to push through more of these ideas. But I think the public is really on to them, and I think that that's a big reason why Barack Obama was elected, was because he was connecting with voters when he started talking about the ideology that had created this mess. But sadly, the Obama administration has really continued with this policy, started under Bush and Paulson, of just an unprecedented transfer of public wealth into private hands under cover of this crisis. And you know, that's the way I see the bailout of the financial sector. You know, if McCain had won the elections, I think you would have had the exact same financial policies, but you wouldn't have had the economic stimulus, which is in some ways a counterbalance, but it's not enough of a counterbalance. And this is what I've been arguing since the start of the economic crisis, is that it isn't, this crisis hasn't been solved. The crisis created by speculative finance has not been solved. It's been moved. So a private sector crisis has become a public sector crisis because so much public money has been devoted to bailing out the banks. The stimulus program is just not big enough to counterbalance this. And so, you know, now you have this huge debt that is largely being offloaded onto the states. So if we really want to see who's paying the price of this bailout, look at what's happening in California. You know, this is a state that's going bankrupt, and Schwarzenegger is dealing with their budget crisis on the backs of the absolutely most vulnerable people in society. So you have schools that, you know, mainly service, you know, Latino communities, and they are having to fire a third of their teachers. So this is the real shock. This is the real shock doctrine. It's not just the transfer of public money into the hands of the bankers. It's who ultimately pays for that.
So if I get you right, Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine is sort of working two ways. One, it really created the crisis with the deregulation of financial institutions and the sort of free market mania that allowed for all this rampant speculation. Then once the crisis comes, it uses the crisis as an opportunity to gut social programs that much further.
Yeah, and I mean it's also not a master plan. You know, these crises, these shocks, are really built into the economic model itself. And, you know, if you eliminate all the rules, you will have a boom and bust, or actually more specifically, a boom and bail cycle, where you make a lot of money really, really quickly, get yourself into a lot of trouble, and then turn to the state to bail you out. So I'm not saying that they created, you know, this crisis in order to exploit it. I think this crisis was created because the economic model of deregulation that is so volatile and is so crisis-prone is also an extraordinarily good thing for billionaires. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why we have this economic model. That said, you know, we still have a lot of ideologues making policy, whether it is Larry Summers in the Obama administration, or whether it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, who says, you know, Milton Friedman changed my life, and, you know, that is probably the only economic book he ever read was Milton Friedman's Freedom to Choose. And, you know, he was quite a proselytizer for these policies, so he already believes that government is the problem, not the solution. So they're, you know, very prone to using a crisis to push through more cuts to social spending because they don't believe in government anyway. And, you know, in California, you have the added layer of, you know, nationally you have the crisis that was created by deregulation. But in California, you know, one of the tenets of this sort of right-wing revolution has been not just to ram through their, you know, cut taxes and deregulate policies, but to try to lock them in to make it harder for predecessors to change the rules after them. And that's the situation you have in California, where it's you need a two-thirds majority to raise taxes. And so that's why it's been so difficult to address the crisis in any other way than slashing the budget. So, yeah, I mean, this is definitely a crisis in California created by the ideology.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Naomi Klein, joining us live on the phone from Toronto. She's the author of The Shock Doctrine. We've been talking about that right now. Also, No Logo. She is the co-director or filmmaker of the film The Take, made with Avi Lewis, and a writer for The Nation and The Guardian. I suspect many of you are familiar with your work. If you aren't, you're going to want to be. The number here at Media Matters, WILLAM580, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Naomi Klein, I mean, this crisis began on Wall Street. It began with deregulation to a large extent in the housing speculative boom. But it is very much a global crisis, and I think Americans, they sort of gather that if they watch the news, but most Americans don't leave the country, they don't travel. You're Canadian, you have the privilege of traveling around the world. What does this economic crisis look like outside the United States?
Well, I mean, it's a huge question. I think, you know, in some ways, the United States is a little bit, it is unique because of the Obama element, where in the midst of the crisis, you had this sort of very dramatic changing of the guards with a huge amount of hope, obviously, invested in what this change would mean. In most parts of the world, you've got the same government or a government a lot like it, you know, in power before and in the midst of the crisis. And I actually think that that means that there's been more popular resistance to the attempts to exploit the crisis. I think, you know, in the United States, there hasn't been a lot of protesting and a lot of political activism in the face of what a lot of people see as, you know, looting of the public coffers, because there is this sort of perennial hope that Obama's about to usher in a new era. Whereas if you compare that with Italy, where you have, you know, a very unpopular president, Silvio Berlusconi, who used the crisis to crack down on unions, to privatize post-secondary education, raise tuition, things like that, you know, people were just right in his face right away because they already didn't trust him, you know. And so I think there's been a lot more activism in the face of the crisis, challenging government priorities. If you think about Greece, there were these huge, huge protests last January of students, I think it was last December, of students who you adopted this slogan, "We won't pay for your crisis," and, you know, talking about the double standards, where you've got this whole generation of young people who've been told there's not enough money for education, we can't help you get jobs, but then when the banks get into trouble, there's endless amounts of money to bail them out. So these double standards are really, they're really galvanizing young people, and I think because this is the generation that grew up being told that government couldn't do anything, you know, fully immersed in the ideology that, you know, what Paul Krugman calls the can't-do government. You've got a problem with story, you know, leave it to the market. And so when you witness the incredible activism that our governments are capable of marshaling when it comes to saving the elites from their own mistakes, then it necessarily begs the question, why can't you solve any of the problems we're concerned about? Why can't you do anything about global warming? Why can't you, you know, why can't you provide health care? And I do think that that is happening in the United States, when you see it very clearly in the quite militant demands for real health care reform. But I think the Obama moment, ironically, makes people a little bit more forgiving and a little too trusting in power. You know, in moments like this, you should be as suspicious as possible of power. You can't be too suspicious. And I think the sort of hero worship around Obama has been a real detriment to the building of the kind of movements that we need in a moment like this.
You talk about the similar nature of the policies Obama has pursued to what McCain would have pursued toward the financial sector and what Bush was pursuing, and oftentimes the same people involved in the policymaking process.
Geithner.
Geithner and, you know, Bernanke, obviously, mm-hmm. who was the head of the Fed under both administrations and seems to be comfortable with both. Mm-hmm. What about foreign policy? Obama ran for president as the peace candidate initially. That was his sort of distinguishing feature versus Hillary Clinton, was mm-hmm. that he had opposed the Iraq invasion at the beginning. Have you been surprised by his policy toward Iraq and towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, or is this pretty much what
you expected? I haven't been surprised, frankly, because he said as much during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what we're really talking about is just the problem of a two-party system. Because, during the campaign, he was pretty clear that he was not talking about withdrawing from Iraq. He was talking about downscaling the occupation and escalating in Afghanistan. So I'm not sure we can completely I don't believe we have the right to be surprised
mm-hmm.
by the fact that he is actually doing what he campaigned on. The real question is, why during the campaign were people who had been part of the anti-war movement so eager to present him as a peace candidate when, in fact, he was campaigning on a very militaristic campaign, which he's largely made good on? I think a question for groups like Move On and I am Canadian, and I'm really glad that McCain didn't win the election, and it's ultimately a question of, I think it's what happens when activists start thinking like political strategists instead of principled activists. But I suppose the counterargument to what I'm saying is it worked, right? He did win the election, and McCain didn't win, and that's worth whatever problems that has created. But I do think it is worth remembering that he campaigned on this.
Our guest, Naomi Klein, joining us live on the phone from Toronto. Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine and of No Logo, both international bestsellers. And Naomi, I noticed they've been translated into 28 and 29 languages, respectively. Absolutely astonishing. Also a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian. If people want to call in with questions or comments for Naomi Klein, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Naomi,
wanted to add one other thing.
Oh, sure, please do.
Previous thread is just, I don't want to, be hopeless about this. I mean, I am alarmed by the escalation in Afghanistan and I'm not surprised, but it's certainly about his policies in Iraq. But I'm opposed to them, and I do think that because of the radicalism of the Bush-Cheney years, and the desire to just get them out at all costs, and have a sane government as opposed to an insane government, there has been the Democratic Party has been kind of like the Borg, all of these independent movements. We did have an independent peace movement, an independent anti-war movement, but all of it kind of got sucked into this, we just have to get the Republicans out. And so I feel like we're actually in a good moment right now because the Democrats kind of have their act together in terms of getting elected. They've got majorities in the Senate and Congress, and so what that means is that all these activist groups and supposedly independent media organizations and blogs don't need to act like they are an arm of the Democratic Party anymore. We can get back to our independent roles as activists, as journalists, and I think it's really urgent that we do that and take comfort in the fact that the Republican Party is destroying itself, doing a very good job of alienating voters. And, the Democrats appear to be very good at electoral strategy. So leave it to them for a while and rebuild principle-based movements.
How good of a job? I mean, you suggest some people have done a good job, that some haven't. On balance, do you think these sort of peace movement, social movement, community in the United States that aggressively supported Obama and aggressively opposed the Republicans, do you think there still is too much of an issue that they don't want to be too critical of Obama for fear that they will sort of antagonize their connection to power? Some other reason for that matter.
One thing that the Obama administration has been very good at is co-opting progressives, inviting people to cocktail parties and meetings at the White House. And you know, once you are, you know, getting access to an unprecedented degree in that way, then you don't want to lose it. You know, I'm not saying I'm getting White House invitations, I'm not, but you know, I always, when I do get political invitations, I'm always wary of it. I don't find it helps me do my job,
mm-hmm.
And I actually find that it compromises me. I think I see things clear when I have a little bit of distance from power.
Well, that reminds me, if I can interject, Naomi Klein, that, you know, the famous journalist I.F. Stone made it a cardinal principle to avoid those sort of social relationships, mm-hmm. for exactly the reason you're mentioning.
And you know, I think it's tricky. I mean, I've been working on a piece now for Harper's. It'll be out in September, and it's about the two UN conferences on racism. One happened in Durban in 2001, and one just happened in Geneva. It was called Durban 2. And there were huge battles, you know, behind the scenes over whether or not the Obama administration would go to what opponents were calling Durban 2 is actually properly called the Durban Review Conference. The people who most wanted Obama to come were the civil rights leadership in groups like the NAACP, the Leadership Council on Civil Rights, also the Congressional Black Caucus. Some of the large human rights groups felt strongly about it. But a lot of these groups were getting access to the White House in a way that they had not for years. So you had the opponents of the conference taking their opposition to the public and really threatening the administration. Like, if you go to this, you know, it means that you don't care about Israel, that you don't care about Jews, you know, really just taking the gloves off mm-hmm. and treating it like a litmus test. And then you had another group of people who wanted him to go but were not willing to street fight. You know, we're not willing to slam him publicly. We're not willing to take their case to the public, thought they could win this behind closed doors. And what you see is actually that that's not how you win, and they boycotted. And I think that actually says something about how you get things done.
Our guest, Naomi Klein. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Coming to you live, so the phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to some patient callers. Let's start with line one, a cell phone. You're on the air with Naomi Klein. Yes, well, line one.
Champagne?
Yes, that's you.
Okay, you hear me? Okay, I thought I was on a different line. I'm sorry. Just two comments. One, I really love your books. Two, that's not the comment, but I've seen you a few times on Charlie Rose, and the last time it was with a gentleman, I can't think of his name.
It was with Bill Greider, William Greider.
Okay. And my comment in that regard is that Mr. Rose always seems to me to be uncomfortable with your views, and I'm not sure if that's just a misperception on my part or not, but I do notice when he has an industrialist or some great financier, he seems much more animated, but he does seem very uncomfortable with those that are to the left to a certain degree. That's just comment mm-hmm. number one. Number two, I think some leftists are to some extent look back on the year of Franklin Roosevelt as something of a golden age, but I wonder if we were all transported back in time, we'd be as frustrated with him as we are with Obama. Those are just my comments, and
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Naomi Klein?
Yeah, thanks for the call. And, you know, people can watch those Charlie Rose interviews on his website and judge for themselves whether I make him uncomfortable. you know, I think that it's absolutely true that if we were in that FDR moment, if it were, you know, 1934, certainly 1937, when FDR started really pulling back from the New Deal, we would have been furious, and people were furious. You know, there were, in 1937, which was the year that FDR started kind of scaling back the New Deal, which proved to be disastrous, and the country started slipping into recession again, and it really wasn't until the Second World War that you really had the economic recovery. When that happened, that year, 1937, there were more than 4,000 strikes in America. And, you know, there were only 21 strikes major job actions. The last year they've released records for 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, progressives were angry, and they were in the streets, and they were joining other political parties, and it was that pressure that FDR felt that made him, that moved him to the left. Yeah, he was worried about Huey Long. He was worried about Upton Sinclair and Upton Sinclair's run for the governorship of California. And it was under that type of pressure that he deepened the New Deal. You know, in the New Deal, we talk about it as if it was one grand policy, but it started to be introduced in 1933, but there were add-ons and add-ons and add-ons, and as a response to that radicalism, and Social Security was a response to people saying this isn't enough. I think the real problem is the way we teach history in North America is so much the great men theory of history. So it's mm-hmm. just it's the FDR speech, it's FDR handing down these wonderful social programs from on high because he was such a great guy, and we wonder why Obama doesn't do it. And those thousands of strikes that were putting pressure on him and, you know, those third parties and all of that ferment, is erased from the story.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Naomi Klein, who you've just been listening to, the author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters here at WILLAM 580, the number 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line now. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like for you to continue the thoughts you were just doing with about FDR. I must say, I got on Obama's wagon way back when he gave that speech to the Democratic Convention. I said, we got a guy that's articulate, can stand up and talk to anybody. Then, when he became president, they started enumerating some of the things he's doing. A large number of them are still following Bush's policies. And that confused me quite a bit. So I thought, well, it may be the mechanics of the thing. Maybe the same bureaucracy's working that Bush had, and Obama hasn't weeded out those people. Mm-hmm. I'd just like for you to stir that up a little bit, mm-hmm. because just this last thing I heard just an hour before here is that he's not going to allow the list of visitors to the president mm-hmm. be publicized, and that's one thing the Bush people wanted not to have done, and they mm-hmm. did it. He's continued it. So I think there's these little patches of holes are starting to show up, mm-hmm. and I'm beginning to think, well, I've been taken in again. And I don't feel so bad about it because there's other things nice going on, but I still wonder if there's some historical perspective on this, that this is not that uncommon, or maybe it is unusual for a president to come in and take over a large number of policies the previous person had, the people that were rotten, and he continues them for some reason or another. Thanks a lot. Good program.
Well, thank
nice
you very much,
around
caller.
On this earth, lady. Very nice.
Thank you, caller. Naomi Klein?
A great question. I think that maybe part of the problem is just that a lot of us like Obama so much that he certainly seems so sort of intuitively progressive, and he's clearly a very compassionate person, and a very authentic. He comes off as a very authentic person, but I just feel like we shouldn't make this too personal. I mean, I think the idea of us sort of being taken in is. I think it's the wrong way to go. It's that great FDR story. We don't know if it's true or not, but Harry Belafonte says that Eleanor Roosevelt told him this story in the context of the civil rights movement of FDR meeting with the civil rights leader and proposing a policy that FDR didn't think he could sell politically, and FDR said, now go out there and make me do it. I.e., change the political culture. So that I can sell this, so that I can say we don't have a choice. There's too much pressure from below. Obama is an incredibly cautious politician. I mean, if you think about how cautious his campaign is, his campaign was. He tried to give the right and the media in this country, and it's very hard to tell the two apart, just as little to work with as possible. So he really tried to close the gap whenever he could between himself and McCain. he is a centrist. He's a very, very cautious guy, and this seems to work as a political strategy. The problem is we are in a moment that requires audacity. And that's why, you know, I've been using this phrase, you know, Obama's a centrist. It's our job to move the center. Because I do think he is, where he is different from Bush is that Bush and Cheney and their whole gang were utterly uninterested, utterly tone deaf to public opinion. And they were not inclined to do anything that I would describe as the right thing. I think with Obama, the difference is he is open to pressure. We've seen him move on quite a few things in the face of public pressure. And that is his strength and his weakness. Right now, he's under a huge amount of pressure from the lobbyists, from just the Democratic Party machinery. And I think that progressives aren't forming enough of a counter pressure to allow Obama, the centrist, to come up with a compromise that's decent. That's why, you know, this whole sort of obsession with partisanship, that's not, you know, we don't want Obama compromising between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. That will leave us very far to the right. You know, we want him compromising between, you know, a unapologetically progressive grassroots movement, making real demands for universal health care, getting out of Iraq, and, you know, and that being the pull. Right, so we can't be afraid to really move that to move that pole, so that he can find a different center, find a better center. I don't think it's really about being taken in, but I do think that we also can't say, well, you know, this is just the sort of inertia of politics, and he's surrounding himself. You know, he has, you know, he's inherited these policies, and he's inherited people from the Bush administration, because frankly, it's worse than that. He chose an economic team. No one forced him to. That is, you know, incredibly pro-business, incredibly pro-Wall Street. Larry Summers being the most spectacular example of that. Nobody forced him to do that. And in his other appointments, he has tended to gravitate towards people who are very safe politically and are not terrifically brave. And that's a problem if you're fighting for healthcare policy or if you're fighting for, you know, a real shift in environmental policy. His cautiousness is a problem.
Naomi Klein, one of the areas some would say his cautiousness has come forth is with U.S. policy towards the Middle East, specifically Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. I know you've written about this issue, and I know you're about to go to Israel, if I'm not mistaken, in the next few days.
Yeah.
What is your sense of where we're at, if I can ask sort of a bigger picture, with Israel-Palestine now at this moment historically? Are we at a moment where things can change in any fundamental way? And what role is the United States playing in the process under Obama compared to what Bush was doing?
You know, this is, it is so tricky because, you know, the Bush administration moved this center, you know, just moved the terrain so, and got us used to such incredibly regressive ideas and policies that things that are not really all that progressive seem progressive when Obama does them. You know, the Bush administration was so belligerently, I wouldn't even say pro-Israel. I mean, they were Likud. They were a specific part of, you know, the Israeli political spectrum. And there was utter indifference to Palestinian suffering. And that was a shift. You know, that was a shift from the Clinton years. And when Obama made the speech in Cairo, it did matter. You know, I'm not, some people say, well, it's just words, it doesn't matter. But I think it does matter for the most powerful man on earth to acknowledge Palestinian suffering in the way that Obama did in that speech. I think it would have been much more powerful if he'd gone to Gaza. I know that may seem crazy, but you know, crazier things have happened. What I worry about, you know, is coming back to the, you know, the previous discussion about his cautiousness, is that, you know, now the pushback comes. So, you know, he took a risk he took a few risks in that speech in Cairo. It was not by any means a radical speech, not by any means like that progressive a position. But now he's getting this huge pushback from the right, and in Israel, you know, his popularity has plummeted. And the problem is he hearing from enough Americans that they care about the Middle East, they care about Palestinians, that they want the embargo lifted on Gaza, you know, that they absolutely, passionately believe that the settlements are illegal, right? What I see is actually that the anti-war movement has been, in general, has been, obviously with some exceptions, Code Pink has been sending delegations to Gaza, which I think is terrific. But a lot of the, you know, mainline voice, anti-war voices in the States steer clear of the Middle East. They think it's too complicated. They don't want to wade into what feels like, you know, an ethnic conflict. They don't, you know, this, so they just stay away from it. And once again, you know, we're going to have what I believe is Obama's going to be pushed out, and we're already seeing examples of this where he's going to weaken what was already a weak position. You know, his position was no new settlements, right? Mm-hmm. That is not a progressive policy. A progressive policy is end the occupation and get rid of all the settlements. The wall is illegal because it is an annex. It annexes occupied territory. That's illegal under the Geneva Conventions. The UN has ruled that again and again and again. So you have a position that already isn't progressive, just to say no new settlements. And then you have this enormous pushback from the right. And where are the voices on the left that are actually saying, excuse me, no new settlements? How about no settlements? And that's what's really doing us in.
Our guest today, Naomi Klein. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Naomi Klein, the author of two international bestsellers, The Shock Doctrine and No Logo, also a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian. It's an honor to have her on our program. The phone number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. A lot is going on in Iran right now, and I don't know what sort of information you have access to, Naomi Klein, but what is your general sense of what's going on in Iran from your perch in Toronto and its importance?
I don't feel like much of an expert, you know, on this. I've been following it along with everybody else, and it's, you know, it's enormously just heartbreaking to see whenever you see idealism, solidarity, joy, just squashed with raw force, you know, and that's what's been happening. Yesterday, that's, you know, with this bloody crackdown, you know, when you see these crowds, I know that feeling because I've been, you know, lucky to have been part of a few really powerful historical moments in my life as a journalist. And, you know, when you're in those moments, you can't imagine the state using force in this way, because you have so many people on your side and the cause feels so just, and I think in this case it's absolutely just, that you just believe, you know, you've seen so many Hollywood movies and you think you're going to get yourself a Hollywood ending, and then they just come in with the guns. And, you know, it doesn't always end that way. But that's what is heartbreaking about this moment.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hi. I actually wanted to ask a broader question about how you reframe some incidents in recent foreign policy and recent world history. The Iranian situation, I mean, it's so easy to be called an apologist for the regime when speculates that actually Ahmadinejad probably did win the election. And, I mean, obviously people are saying it's gone so far beyond that, and there are all sorts of grievances, but if there is a commitment to democracy, we can't sort of just blithely ignore that is a strong possibility. There's some interesting calculations that Bob Naiman has done, Just Foreign Policy. I don't know if it's actually up on his website yet, but I think that we need to look at the manipulation that's going on, the $300 million of CIA destabilization money that just happened at the 2 years before the end of the Bush administration. I don't actually know how fast they spend that money, but, you know, it looks too much like a destabilization campaign. Not to say that
I don't think that gives Iranians enough credit, to be honest. I mean, I understand, and I've, you know, I think some of those dollars are at work. But the fact is, you know, I think what I don't think that this is just about who won elections in a rigged democracy with an extremely narrow political spectrum. I think what we're seeing on the streets is, you know, a popular revolt against a repressive regime. And, you know, whenever that happens, you know, to me it's pretty clear whose side we should be on.
Well, I generally agree with you, but I'm afraid I have to take
I think Ahmadinejad probably got more votes.
Right.
But I do think that
we have, the U.S. cannot say that it hasn't had its electoral irregularities, that's for sure. I mean, who are we to be pointing out other people's foibles? But I think there is a rule, it's such a hard thing to navigate the progressive
That doesn't
critique.
Mean, but I think that we can still have a very clear stand on the use of state violence.
Of course.
On unarmed protesters.
Yes, I agree.
You know, there have been, you know, if you think about what happened in the Mexican elections, the last national elections, where you had a contested vote, and you had the candidate who officially lost, basically occupying the Zocalo for weeks, creating a parallel government. You know, the Mexican state, and they're no human rights champions, didn't bring in, you know, the tanks, right? There are different ways of handling this.
Well, well, I thought you were going to make the point that they are not an official enemy. Mexico is. We wanted Caldera in.
We're doing this in the United States. I mean, this is the thing that I do. I think there can be a little bit of kind of American arrogance to, the U.S. government has intervened and interfered all around the world. But I think in some ways, like tracing U.S. dollars and tracing U.S. interference, we run the risk of becoming almost myopic in the analysis, where everything is about us, everything is about, you know, as everything is about our dollars and our influence, and it denies the agency of people who, you know, genuinely, clearly are sick and tired of being told how to live by religious fundamentalists.
Well, I'm wondering about our agency, and what, you know, the point is that there's no commitment by the Obama administration to look at the crimes of the Bush administration in so many dimensions, and including this one with destabilization of Iran. And I'm not confident that it hasn't gone ahead after Bush's election. The Democratic leadership was all on this $400 million of CIA destabilization money, and it's very little commented on. The point that really initiated my impulse to call and is the way you reframe sort of solidarity in Tiananmen Square, and those are, you know, also events that can be interpreted different ways. And I just wanted to give you a chance to sort of reframe them in the way that you see them, that they were based to a large extent. The solidarity was a worker control sort of a phenomena. So I think we can get confident on that one and let the other controversy hang in the air. I appreciate the colloquy. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, caller. Naomi, solidarity, Tiananmen Square?
Well, I mean, what the caller was referring to is you know, one of the things that I try to do in this alternative history of 30 years of the spread of this fundamentalist form of capitalism is challenge the claim that there was no alternative. You know, this is the Thatcher claim, there is no alternative, that this ideology triumphed because there was no other. And the idea behind that was basically claiming that there really are only two ideologies, authoritarian communism, and liberal democracy and free markets, and denying that actually there are all kinds of different economic models between those poles, and that at many of these junctures where crisis was used to insist on free market shock therapy, the people actually in the countries affected were very clear on the alternative that they favored. And solidarity is a particularly solidarity in Poland is a particularly dramatic example, because this was the first Eastern Bloc country in 1989 that had open elections, that had free elections. It wasn't entirely open. The Communist Party held on to some of the seats, but solidarity just swept the elections in the seats that they were allowed to run in. And it was, you know, this was the event that really ultimately led to the domino effect that the Berlin Wall and ultimately the collapse of the Soviet Union. But what was striking, though, in this example, is that this was a country that also inherited an economic crisis. That's, you know, usually governments fall because they're falling apart. And so they inherited the economic crisis from the communists. And that crisis was leveraged by Washington, by the International Monetary Fund, to say, well, we're not going to help you. We're not going to give you a loan unless you go the free market route. But what people had actually voted for in those elections was an economic program that held that the state factories should not be privatized. They should be turned into worker cooperatives and should be run by their workers. And so I do this, you know, in all of the sort of country studies that I do, I try to pull out the alternative, the road not taken, the alternative that people voted for,
mm-hmm.
And actually that they never got a chance to try. Because I think it is really important, because this idea that our ideas have all failed is something that I think a lot of people on the left have internalized and really believe that there is something wrong with our ideas, and it's, and they associate them with authoritarian communism, and so they're all tainted. But if you look at an idea like worker cooperatives, actually the places where they have been tried, they've been incredibly successful, and in many cases people wanted them but didn't get a chance to try them.
Let's go back to our final caller now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Yes, hi. Thanks for your comments. I wanted to go back to where you were talking about Obama's cautiousness and the perception that there, you know, where are the voices on the left? And this kind of probably goes without saying to the Media Matters audience, but you know, I wonder what you think about how much it is contributed to by a corporate-owned media that really does seems to me to be have more of a right-wing bias that doesn't allow more progressive voices to be heard. And so I just wanted your comments on that. Thanks.
It's a huge part of it, and thank you for adding it to the discussion. And I think, you know, it's the effect of a corporate media that presents such a narrow range of debate. And, you know, somebody else talked about how uncomfortable I make Charlie Rose. Well, you know, true, I clearly make the guy uncomfortable, but, you know, at least he has me on, unlike, you know, much of the corporate media. But I think that what happens is it's not just that lots of people agree with, say, what I was describing about what the actual Middle East position should be. It's not, and they just can't get on television. It's that when you don't have the people on television making the argument in a convincing way, then the people out there who might think it is a little bit weird that Obama is only talking about no new settlements, right, think that they're crazy, right? And internalize the narrowness of the debate and start believing that it really is an extremist position to say no settlements, even though the settlements are all illegal, right? So, you know, in a democracy, you know, in a healthy society, what the media does is make us feel less alone. You know, we have our views confirmed, deepened, reflected back. When that doesn't happen, we start thinking we're the crazy ones. And so it isn't just about, well, those views are out there, but they're not reflected in the media. The media changes. The lack of views in the media, the narrowness of the range of opinion, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we all start believing that this spectrum of debate is actually acceptable.
Naomi, along these lines, someone like President Obama, do you think it's a factor that when he appoints Robert Gates to stay on as Secretary of Defense, or brings on a Geithner and a Larry Summers to run financial policy, that this is almost unanimously adored by the news media. I mean, as a sign of his temperance and wisdom. And that were he to, you know, bring in Joe Stiglitz or someone like that to run the economic policy, or adopt, you know, put Dennis Kucinich as Secretary of Defense, I think it's not unfair to say he would be regarded by the news media as a candidate for, especially the latter, for impeachment, that he would have lost his senses. I mean, does the media play that disciplinary role that really encourages someone in power to go in a particular direction?
Absolutely, and you know, and I think it's Obama's the role that Obama is playing and will continue to play if he is the cautious person, if we let him be the cautious person that he is. He's really making the elites, and you know, our media, the voices on cable television, they are the elites. You know, they are part of. You know, journalists used to be, you know, working class. Here we're talking about an extraordinarily privileged group, multi-millionaires for the most part, making, you know, defining this range of opinion. And I think what started to happen during the Bush years, or what happened during the Bush years, is with the exception of Fox, most sort of cosmopolitan members of the elite were embarrassed of Bush. Were embarrassed of being represented by you know, people who believed in creationism and made them embarrassed when they went to Europe, okay? and I think what Obama is doing for the elites, and I'm including the media elites in this, is making them feel better about themselves. And, yeah, appointing a Joseph Stiglitz, you know, or a Kucinich would erode that. You know, at this point, Obama is not taking things to any place that would make those elites feel anything but just better about themselves and the power and privilege that they have. And, you know, I think that that isn't the kind of change that people thought they were going
to
get.
Naomi Klein, we have about a minute and a half left. Let's try to take our last caller, if we can. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Thanks for getting my call in. I read your book, The Shock Doctrine, last winter, and thought it was really very interesting. Been passing it around to all my friends, and it's good to speak with you. I wanted to turn the conversation back towards economics again with the meeting in Russia last week about trying to replace the dollar as a foreign exchange currency and all of that, and, you know, get your opinion on that and how that might relate to eventually back to oil prices and our economic situation. I think I read somewhere that the IMF would normally think that the United States' economic situation was in such bad condition that they might not give us a loan. I'll hang up and get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Naomi Klein?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And not only would the IMF not give the U.S. a loan, but the conditions that it would attach to the loan would bar the economic stimulus program that the Obama administration has introduced, which is a piece of their economic policy that I do support. You know, what the IMF does when it hands out a loan is it says, you know, you have to balance your budget, which means you have to cut back social services, lay off public sector workers. So what the U.S. has, and the U.S. has backed these reforms for decades now around the world, and I think, you know, part of one of the things that's happening now in the midst of the economic crisis, a lot of people are looking at what the U.S. itself does when it's in an economic crisis and going, wait a minute, this is the exact opposite of what you told us to do.
Naomi Klein, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, unfortunately, for us. That means they want to get us out of the studio. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a great trip to Israel, and talk to you when you get back. I want to thank Rich Potter for sitting in as producer today, and Kyle Krohoff for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you all. See you in 167 hours.